Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, editor of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our editor-in-chief, Lisa Henderson. For this edition of the ACT podcast, we are speaking with Dr. Doug Warner, Chief Medical Officer at Effector.
So Doug started his role as CMO at Effect last year, 2022. And prior to that, he spent 18 years at Amgen working in various oncology and development roles. And Doug earned his MD from Duke, his MBA from the UCLA Anderson School of Management, and his bachelor's from University of Pennsylvania, which is basically in my backyard, which is great. So thank you so much for joining us today, Doug.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks, Doug. So I first want to start off, you know, like Lisa said in her part of the intro, you spent over 18 years at Amgen. So I know it's 18 years. I know it's a long time, but could you take us through your time there and how you moved up the ladder?
Sure. I had a great experience at Amgen. I was really able to see the entire process of oncology drug development from early phase one through 2-3 registration, and then launch of new products. And I really started at Amgen on the end of that process. I started in medical affairs, medical communications, and oncology. And in that role, you go out, you talk to investigators, key opinion leaders about trial data, you get their feedback on it, you know, learn about the strengths and weaknesses of different trial designs. And so you can see how the data is interpreted by the treating community. In addition, I also went before P&T committees or pharmacy and technology committees at major medical centers. And those are the folks that are responsible for putting drugs on formulary. And in those interactions, it's another interesting aspect of drug development because you can see some of the interests they have might not really be thought of in the design of clinical trials. So they might be more interested in things like scheduling of drugs. Is there a convenient administration schedule and other aspects of the product profile that might not be evident when you're just focusing on benefit risk when designing a trial? So that was a really good experience to have when going into clinical development. And from there, I went into oncology clinical development, started at the bottom as a medical director, designing phase 1B through 3 trials, global trials, you know, working with a team. So how we worked was we had a matrix team. The medical director was pretty much the head of the team, but we had all of these great component parts, the study manager, the statistician, the regulatory lead. So I really got to see how all of these groups feed in importantly into the process of designing, executing a trial, and evaluating the data. And from there, I became a global development lead of a few products. And there you oversee overall the evidence generation of the product, and you're responsible for that. And you lead a team that helps execute that development plan for the molecules. And I did that in oncology primarily, but I also worked on a non-oncology product. And that also gave me some insights into, you know, how different in many respects developing drugs are in oncology versus non-oncology. Because say in general medicine, the benefit risks are a lot different than in oncology drug development. The benefit risks of the associated drug, there's a different standard. And then from there, I became a group product area lead where I oversaw multiple molecules in different phases of development and oversaw different programs and teams. And I really got a good view of how drugs are developed in different stages and different indications. And, you know, overall got to work with some fabulous people at Amgen. So it was really, you know, a wonderful experience overall. I'd say also that, you know, I just saw incredibly dramatic changes in drug development during that time period. You kind of alluded to 18 years. That's quite a long time. And in oncology in particular, there's just been an explosion of advancements in, thankfully, in drug development and the science behind new oncology drugs. So that's really created tremendous opportunities in the field. Some challenges, but for the most part, great opportunities in oncology.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's a lot of things that you said in there that I wrote down that I want to follow up with. I guess, first off, you just left Amgen and Effector. So what was the attraction for that move?
So I felt at Amgen, I'd kind of developed a really great skill set to move on to the next level. And I felt Effector was just a wonderful opportunity. The management team was fantastic. They have 2 molecules that hold a lot of promise and are in clinical stage. And so it was a wonderful opportunity, it's really exciting opportunity to lead the whole clinical and medical program and work with management to drive things forward.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell from your explanation, you know, so holistic, all your experience that you can bring to that. So that's great. So you worked closely with the major regulatory agencies, and you also said, you know, there's differences in trial design, in benefit of risk and everything, but between oncology and non-oncology drugs. But what are some of the regulatory challenges that you saw that are unique to oncology trials?
Yeah, great question. In oncology, the gold standard is overall survival. And that's really what we all want to see, is an improvement in overall survival in patients getting treated with cancer drugs. But that's unfortunately many times difficult to show in a trial. I'll give you a few examples. If you're designing a trial upfront or an early treatment of metastatic disease, patients might live quite a long time. And so to get that overall survival data might take many years, and that would delay the amount of time it takes to get the drug to market. Now, regulators have offered things like surrogate endpoints, for instance, progression-free survival is an example. And that would be the time until the patient's disease progresses or the patient dies. And so those endpoints come in earlier. But then the question is, what does PFS mean? Some regulators look at it differently. They want to see a large difference in progression-free survival, and not only a large difference, but a difference that shows the patients are also doing well on the therapy. In other words, if you're giving a drug that increases the time to disease progression, if it's causing all kinds of toxicity, that's really not very good for the patient. They're getting extra time, but that time is not very quality time. So how do you deal with this conundrum of showing overall survival, and what sort of endpoints can you use as surrogates or proxies for overall survival? That's one big thing in oncology drug development. Another is biomarker development. You know, we want to have all our ducks in a row and identify a biomarker prior to entry into your later stage clinical trials. Sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes you figure out the biomarker pretty deep in your development program. And so then how do you backtrack and figure out a way to select for a biomarker population or analyze data in that specific biomarker population in a clinical trial setting that's a rigorous study without wasting, I wouldn't say wasting, without delaying the development process pretty significantly. And also associated with biomarker development, once again, biomarkers are a way to identify a particular patient population that might respond better than the overall population. Also, you know, it's referred to as targeted medicine or personalized medicine. You need a companion diagnostic to pick out those patients. And most companies do not have in-house companion diagnostics. Some do, some major players do, but a lot don't. And in that setting, you have to partner with a companion diagnostic company. So that just creates extra complexity in the process. And then another example would be, oftentimes we're dealing with pretty rare diseases in oncology. And so what do you do? How do you design a trial to evaluate the activity of a drug in a very small population? So small, you wouldn't want to put a patient on a placebo because you don't have that many patients to begin with. And how do you enroll those patient populations? You know, that's a major undertaking. It's some cases it's trying to find a needle in a haystack. And then how do you assess benefit in often what is a single arm trial because you don't have enough patients for a larger development program? I probably can go on and on about different challenges, but I think, you know, the regulators for the most part want to do what's best for patients. Well, they do want to do what's best for patients, and they want to partner with biopharma to make that happen. So it's a real partnership. It's just that there are these issues that are very complex and you know, need to be dealt with individually with different regulatory agencies because different regulators view them through different perspectives.
Great. Thank you, Doug. So you just took us through all the, you know, specific regulatory challenges and just the different aspects that make oncology trials so unique. It's kind of a different animal. So, you know, how can industry navigate trials in a crowded oncology market?
Yeah, it's incredibly crowded. And I think that the foundation of any successful clinical trial is the partnership with sites and the relationship with sites. And first principles of that is do not burden sites. You know, create protocols that don't overly burden sites and patients. So I know in drug development, we try to, for good reason, collect as much data as possible because we really want to assess the potential benefits and the potential risks. So that involves a lot of potentially imaging assessments, lab data collection, other data collection, patient-reported outcome instruments. There are a whole host of things we can collect in these trials, but that often provides or creates quite a burden for sites and for patients. So there really has to be a balance in our understanding of wanting to execute these trials in an efficient way to get to the data that ultimately will advance oncology, and at the same time, trying to collect the data we need and not burden sites. So I think that's key, is that we have to become really partners with sites, listen to what they're saying when they're talking about different burdens and challenges they have with trial execution. So that's really important. And as you work with sites, you know, as a sponsor, you tend to work with the same sites over and over again, where you have that productive relationship where it's really you're getting feedback from the sites that you're going back and taking into consideration when you're developing future trials. I think another thing is just over-communication. You know, there's always reasons to communicate to sites about things, but of course, sites are quite busy. They have many trials. They have active clinical practices. We know going into COVID, coming out of COVID, sites were really strapped for clinical trial personnel. I was hearing that all the time. So they were short-staffed. So, you know, I would say just make sure you prioritize what you need from sites and give them heads up on when you need it and what you need. And that'll help smooth out the process quite a bit.
Based on everything you said, it's the complexity, the rare diseases that, you know, you might need an in-house, you know, partner with a diagnostics company. There's lab assessments, maybe the biomarker abilities, and all of that is just complex. So what advice would you give for clinical operations professionals managing these trials?
So I would first turn that around and say, what do we expect from the medical clinical development staff? Because it's often the study ops, study management, you know, in the field or on the front lines talking to sites, and the medical director might not get involved in the day-to-day as much. But the medical staff needs to have a great partnership with your study management team and empower your study management team. I think that's so important. I always say to my medical directors that, you know, your study manager and your statistician are your best friends, right? So you have to make sure they're empowered. They know when they can make decisions on their own. I also say for the study management professionals, you know, don't be afraid to be familiar with the disease state, familiar with the protocol, you know when to escalate things up the chain, try to understand when not to. As you say, it's quite complex, but I think it all starts with a good team and good partnerships between the different functional groups on the team. So knowing how to interact with the different team members, when to escalate, when not to, that sort of thing.
That's great advice. I guess everybody's going to want to work for you.
You're too kind.
So changing pace into some of the work that you've done, Doug, in your own career, you're the co-author on some peer-reviewed articles in The Lancet Oncology, and the Journal of Clinical Oncology. So could you take us through your work on some of those?
Sure. The majority of those were in large phase three global studies, and I was really fortunate to be part of those. It's quite an undertaking to do something like that. And once again, bringing it back to sort of first principles of study design and execution, it takes a lot of good teamwork because some of these trials are massive. So for instance, one of the trials I worked on in multiple myeloma was one of the, if not the largest trial, international trial in multiple myeloma. So trying to successfully execute something like that is kind of like steering a huge ship. And so it starts at the beginning with working with your study management team to select the right sites, understanding the different regulatory viewpoints in different regions of the world, understanding the different standards of care in different regions of the world. You might not be able to go into certain countries because the standard of care is different or because the regulatory requirements are different. And so really designing the study at the beginning to ensure for success is really important. And that's working hand in hand with your study team to select the sites, do the submission seamlessly, get back to regulatory and ethics committee seamlessly. And then, you know, really once your trial is underway, it's really trying to cooperate efficiently with people in far-flung regions of the world relative to where we are in the United States, and doing that in a timely manner and adapting to different requirements or different things that might happen. Sometimes you have a protocol that's underway, a large phase three trial, and it's not enrolling overall, or it's not enrolling your particular area of the country. You know, what are the reasons? You can go through different ways to figure that out. Is it a protocol issue? Let's look at the screen fail reports. You know, is there something we can change about the protocol? That sort of thing. And then bringing in the data, which it's a fraught and challenging time because you only have one chance to cut the data, do the database lock. So, you know, once again, it's really teamwork, working with these different groups all over the world to try to make sure the data is in, the data is correct, query the sites where you're unsure about particular data that's entered, and make sure at that database lock point, you know, everybody's set and confident in the quality of the data. Yeah, so that's what I learned from many of those studies, which were, as I said, were huge studies globally. They're just, once again, so many moving parts. It takes great, really great people across the different functional groups to make that happen. I think, you know, the medical team that, you know, I played a part, but certainly, you know, there would not be any success without the broader planning and teamwork that goes into execute something like that.
So with all the changes, where do you see oncology trials in the next 5 years?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think there's been a real push for this idea of decentralized clinical trials.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah, I think FDA just released their revised guidance this week on that, and they're hoping to have a completed guidance by the end of the year. And decentralized clinical trials basically means some or all of the interaction with the patient will not be happening at standard clinical trial sites. And there are, as you imagine, many, many benefits to that. You know, it relieves a great burden from patients who have to come in regularly. You know, there are trials where patients, you know, particularly in rare diseases, where patients have to fly to a different state or fly to a different country for their regular visits, you know, their every 4 week visits. Where some of these visits, they might not even be receiving study drug, but it's a requirement to be there in person. So, you know, that's just one example. So there's a real need to look at alternatives to the standard model of having patients come in all the time to the clinical trial site for evaluation. As part of that, as well as remote monitoring, probably started with evaluation of drug toxicities that are potentially delayed. There was thinking, well, can we set up somebody with a digital device to evaluate certain parameters at home to evaluate toxicity and get that person medical care if you know they actually need it, if it's pretty severe toxicity. So I think the use of digital devices as part of this decentralized clinical trial planning, I think, will become a bigger factor as well. You know, with the advancements in that technology, there's a real possibility for a lot of these evaluations happening with the patient not even having to leave their house. And that goes not only with, you know, trial visits, but also lab draws, drug administration. It's a little more difficult in oncology with drug administration because, as we know, many of these drugs have to be given under supervision. But at least for the routine visits where, say, you're just doing a physical and collecting some labs, you know, there's a real benefit to the patient and really to drug development in general to not have burden that patient with coming in very frequently. And so I think this whole decentralized clinical trial process has great, great potential. So we'll have to see. You know, it's probably not going to be clear sailing, but I think regulators at least have bought into the idea that was spurred by the pandemic that there's progress that can be made here that really can help people and speed up drug development. I will add that another issue is the use of real-world evidence. And, you know, we've already seen that in many regards. For instance, in one example in oncology would be you have a rare oncology disease, you're conducting a single arm trial. Well, how do you really know what the response rate would be with standard of care if there's not good standard of care literature out there? Where you can look at real world evidence, real world data. There's certain countries that are particularly good integrated electronic medical records that allow you to do that. And there's been at least one approval I know of a drug just based on real world data, not the main approval, but a follow-on approval in a smaller subset of patients where they just looked at efficacy outcomes in real world data and a label was generated from that. So I think those are probably two areas. I'm sure there's a lot of things I'm missing there as well, but we'll have to see how it all plays out in the next 5 years. It's an exciting time to be in drug development.
It certainly is. It gives us a lot to talk about and write about. So I didn't have any additional questions, Doug. I mean, I really enjoyed everything that you had to say about everything. I mean, it just was, you know, Andy and I don't conduct clinical trials. We just write about it. But everything that you had to say was just so insightful, you know, and the work you do is so important and you seem to really enjoy it. It comes through. So thanks for speaking with us. Yeah.
No, my pleasure. I really enjoyed speaking with you, too.